Now, what I want to do is we want to see if we have a Diana Booth available. Let's just ask Michael G., our engineer. Is Diana available?
Yes, she is.
Okay, let's say hello to Diana Booth. Diana, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine, Gary.
Let me give a little background on you. Recently, someone called and says, Gary, I hear that you're out of the city a lot, you're filming. What is it exactly you're doing? What is it, what? And she asked a whole lot of information, and it was a school teacher. And I thought, well, I'll bet a lot of people in the audience are sometimes curious as to when I say I'm filming something or doing something, what is the process? How do you go about doing it? And right now I'm working on a documentary and have been for over a year, just about a year and a half. And Manette Loudon from my office is frontline producing it. We have a lot of people who are doing research. And it deals with the subject that children in the United States, in my opinion, are being abused, starting at the institutional level, the level of government, of governmental agencies, of governmental programs, the court system, the judges, the psychiatrists, psychologists, the social workers, the police. In effect, all well-intentioned, all trying to do the right thing for the children, but with disastrous results. And rarely does anyone stop for a moment and say, is this really right? And because no one is stopping and everyone is just kind of like an assembly line, everyone's got one recipe and it's got to fit every single kid and every single circumstance has to be the same in how it's dealt with. And we have decided to take a look at this in depth. And to do it in depth, I've had to go out to Columbine. We filmed all over the United States. We just filmed today. And I just want to give you one tiny glimpse of one small part of this film by letting you hear in advance one person's story. There are over 80 people whose story is going to be in this documentary. And this is one story of those 80 to give you an idea of why I feel this is important, and to give you some background on who this person is. And her name is Diane Booth, and Diane has just gotten out of jail, and she has a son who was taken away from her, and she has not seen her son, and I want you to hear her story. Now, we have independently ascertained that the facts that she is going to share are correct. I have a responsibility to get independent verification of everything, and it's kind of hard to believe that the system could be so corrupt. Now, I still have to go and film a lot of the people who participated in Diane's difficulties. And whether they will cooperate or not, or whether I'll be, approaching them and they'll put their hand up and say, I don't want to talk with you, well, that remains to be seen. Maybe they'll sit down and have a conversation. I hope so. But we will be trying to get their point of view. In my documentaries, rarely does the opposition ever sit down and give us an opportunity. Unfortunately, my reputation out there in doing my documentaries, they're hard-hitting. And by the way, every single one has won every single major award there is in the world, no matter where they're shown. Our current one, Fatal Fallout, just won two more national awards this week. So, we're known for being responsible. We're known for giving everyone an opportunity. But rarely, rarely does anyone who holds a contrary point of view voluntarily come on and say, yeah, I'll sit down and talk with you. And so we're kind of always working at something of a handicap there. Diane, that said, let's begin. And why don't you give us a little background on your story? Start with what your child was like growing up. Tell us about your child.
He was a beautiful, absolutely normal, happy boy before the county apprehended him. He was a little hyperactive, like most of the males in my family, but it's just normal. And as you mentioned, I think that it's not the children who are too hyperactive, it's the adults have grown less tolerant of childhood behavior, and they just want to medicate them, so-called medicate them, put them on drugs, out of sight, out of mind. And I think that's what's going on besides the fact that the pharmaceutical companies are making billions on peddling drugs to our children. But what happened to me, and it's still an ongoing nightmare, and I will swear on my life and my son's life, and according to God, that what I say is true and correct. And if it was not true and correct, the FBI could have extradited me from Canada, where I lived as a refugee for 3 years. So everything I say is true. It started when Vincent started kindergarten. On his very first day of school, the school kept calling me at work 10 times, 12 times, telling me, your son won't sit still. You know, we need to have a meeting. So I had a meeting with the school psychologist, the social worker, the teachers, and they said, well, you know, your son just won't sit still, and so you're either going to have to medicate him with Ritalin or we're going to have to put him in a special school for special education. I said, no way, neither one. My son is perfectly normal, and I don't know what's going on. I never had any problems with his behavior before. He went to daycare, and no one ever complained of his behavior. He's a very intelligent boy, and I'm not putting him in special ed or labeling him with any label. So they got really angry with me, and one day I came home from work, and there was a card on my door from the Sunnyvale Police Department. It said, please call us regarding your son. I took the card, I called the police, and they said someone would be right over. I immediately got on the phone to tell my mother, I'm talking to my mother, and the next thing I know, the police officer, Terry Schillinger, just walked right through my door without even knocking or anything. He just walked right to my door, walked up to me, grabbed the phone away from me, and he said, you're not calling anyone. Then he slammed me down on the dining room table so hard that the table crashed to the ground. I rolled off of it, and at that point I thought, this guy's insane. I started crawling away from him, and he grabbed me by both of my ankles and pulled me back. He grabbed me so hard that I still have his fingerprint bruise marks in my ankles after 3 years. And I've had problems ever since with the swelling in my legs because he broke blood vessels and everything. But anyway, they put my son into an institution, the children's shelter on Union Avenue in San Jose. There was no investigation done. There was no court order for the police officer to take him. I had no hearing, and they had absolutely no evidence that Vincent needed any medication. But they put him in this children's shelter, which is a for-profit institution, by the way. And the woman who runs the shelter was the mayor of Sunnyvale, where I was arrested. And this institution had also been investigated by the state for code violations as far as too many residents and abuse of the children. It's on record, so anyone can check it out. You know, there's no exaggeration here. There's no lies. Everyone can check out the evidence. This institution has been investigated several times. And as we speak, the FBI is investigating the whole county of Santa Clara for beatings in the juvenile hall and in the jails. They're beating the inmates. And by the way, most of the inmates that I spent time with in jail, I didn't feel belonged there. They were drug addicts. And as I got to know these people...
Okay, Diane, you're getting off the topic.
Okay.
Stay focused.
Okay.
Get back to the issue.
Okay. So Vincent was in this institution, and I had visiting privileges. So every time I would visit him in the institution, he would have bruises all over him, and he would be on all different kinds of drugs. One time I would come in, and he would be all lethargic. The next time I came in, and he would be bouncing off the walls. One time I visited him, and he kept, like, tapping the table with his hand, like, involuntarily. And I just noticed that something was going terribly, terribly wrong here. And my son kept begging me to get him out of there. He said, Mommy, why am I here? Why can't I go home? He couldn't understand it, and I couldn't understand it either. So the final straw was when I went to visit him, and the whole side of his face was bruised and swollen. And so I filed in for an emergency protective order in the federal court, and I took pictures of it as an exhibit, but the judge denied it. So at that point, I thought, well, I'm not going to get any justice here, and I had to save my son's life. I felt my son's life was in danger. So I took him up, I grabbed him, I went to visit him, I just picked him up, and I just walked out of the place, put him in my car, and we drove up to Canada. And we were up there for about 2 months, and my son, off of the drugs, started getting back to normal, and he was happy again, and our lives were getting back to normal. It was wonderful. And then the nightmare happened again. We got pulled over by the RCMP because apparently the FBI had put out a $500,000 bounty for us, and they had 2 felony warrants for my arrest for kidnapping and for fleeing the United States. Well, I had applied for and received 2 valid U.S. passports just before we left, and at the same time, they're trying to charge me with fleeing the United States, so I couldn't figure that one out. But anyway, the police officer took us to the station, and a social worker came and grabbed my son again from me, kicking and screaming. He screamed, "Please, somebody help me. Mommy, please help me." And I couldn't do anything about it. It was just horrible. They took him away. They took him back to California. And the Canadian immigration officer spoke to me and asked me if I wanted to seek political asylum because they had observed me and my son together and they knew how happy we looked and how attached we were and the bond between us. And he knew that my son was in no danger at all with me. So I filed for political asylum and I lived in Canada for 3 years. I worked at the University of British Columbia in the Faculty of Medicine, Department of Family Practice, and on the side I was on the internet every day networking with people. I found out that there were thousands of American families just like me who had the same things happen to them. And most of these people are single mothers, minorities, or people that can't afford expensive attorneys. And those are the people they target. But to this day, I still have not seen my son since the day they tore him from me in Canada. I turned myself in January of this year because I couldn't live with myself. Even though my life was wonderful up in Canada, I could not live with the fact that I didn't know where my son was. I didn't know what they were doing to him. Nobody had seen or heard him since they took him. So I turned myself in January. The immigration man drove me to Washington. I spent 2 weeks in the Okanagan County Jail in Washington State, and I saw a judge there, and the judge there looked at my warrants, and he said, it says no bail on them. And he said, that's illegal in the state of Washington anyway. That's illegal. So he lowered it to $500,000, and then he encouraged me to stay in Washington State and fight it. He said they could file a habeas corpus, which would force the state of California to come up with any kind of valid evidence in order to extradite me, and they had no evidence. So I could have stayed there, but then I thought, no, my son is still in California, and this is not going to help me reunify with him. The only way I'm going to get my son back is to go back in the belly of the beast and fight it from within. So I turned myself in. I went back to California. I spent 4 months in jail down there, and now I was free. I've been released 2 weeks ago, and I think this is because the DA and the judge has been receiving letters from people from all over the world who have read about my story on the internet. And so I think that, coupled with the fact that they had no real evidence against me at all, and they know they're in the wrong, but they tried to cover it up, they released me from jail. But the problem is I still don't know where my son is. I still have no contact with him. My mother writes letters to him, and they're all sent back, returned to sender. My juvenile dependency court attorney said that she saw my son once, but they only let her look at him through the glass. He was not allowed to speak with her. And she said when she observed him, she said he was tall and handsome, but that she could tell that he was heavily drugged because he was making strange mouth movements, like from the side effects of drugs.
So what has happened here, Diane, is your son has been kidnapped, incarcerated in a mental institution by the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, that's the basics. Now, when you're in prison, you notice some unusual behavior, including when you could and could not get up out of a bed,
mm-hmm.
and what the punishment was if you got up out of bed
mm-hmm.
for any reason, to go to the bathroom or get a glass of water in your own cell.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
People have no idea the way they treat prisoners in this county, and I'm certain they treat the children the same way, because in California, a juvenile is treated just as an adult. Well, if they treat the children the way they treat the adults, it is worse than Bosnia. I mean, it was horrible. I mean, I didn't have to go to isolation, but I talked to plenty of other inmates who would do minor things wrong, like get up to get a drink of water, and they had to go to isolation for 10 days, and I wouldn't see them. When they got out, they would look like half dead. And this one woman told me what they did to her when she was put in isolation. She said that they hog-tied her and put her in this little concrete cell, and they took her clothes off, and they put the air conditioning on full blast. And that's like torture, you know, freezing. And they would punish people for just stupid things like, you know, talking to another inmate when they weren't supposed to talk. They would punish us by, we couldn't go outside. There were weeks went by and I didn't see the sun at all. We never got any exercise. We had to stay on our beds 90% of the time. The food was just absolutely horrible. So I had no exercise. I gained 50 pounds in that place. And my legs were swelling up from water weight gain, from getting no exercise. It was just horrible, absolutely horrible. And the guards were so mean and cruel. I actually witnessed sheriffs beating up a male inmate when I was in the holding cell in the court at downtown San Jose. Four or five sheriffs were beating up on this one male inmate, punching him, kicking him, and I was watching through the holding cell window. And the guy was screaming. They twisted his arm back. They broke his arm. The guy screamed, and then one of the sheriffs stomped on his neck. And then they just picked him up. He was all limp, and they just dragged him down the hall. I mean, this goes on all the time. They beat people up for minor, stupid things. And it's not, I realized after I was in this jail for a certain time that I had no reason to fear any of the inmates. It was the correctional officers I had to fear. They were all very sadistic and cruel. And I'm certain that they do treat the children the same way. And it's all over the papers and the San Jose Mercury News about the juvenile hall beatings. The FBI apparently is out there right now investigating.
That's no comfort.
Diane,
I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And we'll look forward to the next step in our process when I go out and I'm going to be confronting every single person involved in your case. The judge, the prosecutor, the social workers, every single one, I'll be there. And let's see what they have to say, because I won't let them dance around any issue. And if they do, there's going to be a camera on them. And then they'll look. They will have made their statement by what they're not willing to say. But at least the larger community out there will know. This is one story, one single story that I've been working on. And it's a part of a larger tapestry in what will be when it's released. And I'm holding it until January to release it. I still have another month and a half of filming to do. And it's going to shake people up. This isn't even the worst of the stories. In fact, this is relatively mild compared to some of the other things you're going to be seeing in the drugging of our children. So, for those of you who want to know, what's it like? What are some of the issues? What goes on? And you realize that there's gross injustices in the United States. And the only way we can correct any of it is to start with one. And stay with it, no matter what it takes, until the truth is revealed and then present that in as objective and fair-minded way as possible and let the public see it. We just did that with Fatal Fallout, and it scares people, but it also is the kind of scaring that wakes you up. I just had, who was it, the Gannett news chain, just did a whole review on the film, a two-page review, and it was very favorable. And also the Connecticut, what was it? I haven't read it yet, but another major paper in Connecticut just did a review as well and gave it a thumbs up. So you start somewhere if you want to make social change and change some things that are not right, and you don't know where it's going to go, what's going to happen, but nothing happens, nothing changes, if you don't make some effort. And that's what we're doing on this. By the way, one of the things we'll be doing is we will be doing a lot of phone work, a lot of tracking down people. I want to interview all the, I'll just show you how I work on this. We've done hundreds and hundreds of interviews. My goodness, we must have 200 hours of filming already. Her segment this morning was about 17 minutes, from which about 9 minutes will end up in the film. This will be a long film. And right behind that, I'm doing the abuses in psychiatry, including electroconvulsive therapy and a lot of other abuses psychiatry is responsible for. We're going to be contacting legislators in the California Assembly and the House. We're going to be contacting social activists and celebrities and policymakers and human rights lawyers to see if we can't get an open investigation so that all of these things from all of the people who have been affected can be made public. And those that withstand the acid test of credibility and documentation and truth, those can be used then as a referendum mandating change. And especially where there is an economic incentive by some of these institutions to keep kids in there and drug them. And a larger issue is, it's an ethical issue. Do we have a right in our society to demand that a mother give her child a very dangerous drug? And I am one of those who believes that that should be the right of the mother, not the state. In this case, the mother knew better, and the state then took away all the power of the individual. And as long as this is done quietly, who's to know for the better? And we want to bring this out of the shadows and let people know. Her name is Diane Booth. You'll see about her story in The Drugging of Our Children. And it's one of 80 stories. And it's done as a series. And you'll see their children. At least some of them have gotten their children back. But some of them are still in jail. And you'll see some of those jailhouse interviews that I've done. Anyhow, we will be making probably 100 phone calls to line up people to interview. So when I go out there, I can do all the interviewing in about 3 or 4 days. And someone who would like to help work on this particular case, the Diane Booth case, you can call and speak with Minette in my office at 646-505-4660, 646-505-4660, extension 161.